Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at history a little bit today, the history of our Wisconsin Capitol with our guest, Michael Edmonds, back with us. He is Director of Programs and Outreach at the at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And he has authored a number of books and articles. His latest is titled The Wisconsin Capitol, Stories of Monuments and Its People. So we'll be taking a look at the very beginnings of Wisconsin government. Here's some stories about the first Capitol buildings. Maybe you remember your first trip to the Capitol. What do you remember about it? What do you want to know about its history? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And Michael Edmonds, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here. Thanks.
You've had a long career that has been focused on history, your whole career. What drew you to that, to history?
I was thinking about this over the weekend and how I perceive time. And I can't remember a time, Larry, when I didn't see myself fitting into a bigger spread, a bigger timeline. So it's just been with me from the start.
Yeah. Why did you decide to write a book about the Capitol?
Well, it's the 100th anniversary of the Capitol, as I hope most of your listeners know, and the legislature formed a 100th anniversary commission. They naturally turned out to the state's premier historical organization and said, "Hell, what would you like to do?" And Ellsworth Brown, our director, said, "Well, we could publish a book and we could do an exhibit." And as head of programs and outreach, I was asked to shepherd those two ideas from Ellsworth's mind into physical reality. So I wrote the book last summer and fall, and the exhibit that's currently in the rotunda until Thanksgiving or so went up in January.
Well, I tell you, I'm really enjoying the book. And it was a little different from what I expected, and in a very good way, actually. I was delighted to read it. You don't start your book with the building of the current Capitol, but you take us way back to the first people who lived here, where the Capitol now stands, I guess we should say. Why was it important for you to get back to that time?
Well, it goes back to that idea of a timeline. Everything fits within a bigger context, and anyone talking about American history, especially history in the southern Wisconsin, needs to incorporate the indigenous peoples who were here before Europeans came.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me to read. And when when you were writing about what really struck me, I was kind of laughing at times about some of the things that happened to people back when we were sort of organizing and having kind of our first Capitol, where we had pigs in the barn or in the basement. And
right, other extraordinary things you don't associate with the dignity of government. Yeah, the first Capitol that was built on the Isthmus in 1837, was pretty shoddily built. Madison was the middle of nowhere. It was hard to get supplies. They cut down trees and made them into lumber right here on the Isthmus. And the floorboards were made from green, unseasoned wood. And when they heated the building, they shrunk so much that you could pass your hand between them. In those early years, local residents were allowed to keep their pigs under the Capitol to protect them from wolves, because wolves were commonplace in downtown Madison in the 1830s. And one legislator recalled that whenever the debates went on too long and he was bored, he would just stick his cane down between the floorboards and stir up the pigs. They would start squealing so much that no further legislative work could be done and the session would be called for the day.
I so laughed when I read that. And I also, the whole structure of government was so different. When we had a Supreme Court, you write about a Supreme Court justice who was essentially rendered penniless because he became the Supreme Court justice.
Right. The economics of living in Madison changed so much after the Civil War that some of the justices who had given up their professions and were living on fixed incomes found themselves unable to pay their bills. And there are some funny stories in the book about great statesmen of the time having to run to the bank and borrow money just to make ends meet.
It was amazing. James Doty is an interesting character. Talk about James Doty and why the Capitol was built in Madison.
Well, your listeners who are familiar with Madison history will have heard this before, but when Madison was declared a territory in 1836, most of the population lived out in southwestern Wisconsin, where lead miners had come, many of them encroaching illegally on Ho-Chunk lands. And there were one or two families in Milwaukee. There was no one at all in Madison. There were a few families in Green Bay. And so when the first Constitutional Convention was called in the fall of 1836, the biggest question was, where should we locate the capital of our new territory? Where will be our seat of government? And Wisconsin at the time was huge. Its western boundary extended all the way to the Dakotas, and north to south it went from the Missouri line to Canada. And so people were proposing putting the capital all sorts of different places. Doty had come to Wisconsin 20 years earlier, become an attorney, and practiced a lot in what today we'd call real estate. And on his way to the convention, he visited the Four Lakes country and decided this would be a great place to locate the capital because of its scenic location and its centrality between the lakeshore and the Mississippi. He had bought up all the best real estate in downtown Madison, what would become downtown Madison, by the time he got to the convention, and he had a map with him that showed the city laid out pretty much as it is today on the isthmus. Now, it was November of 1836, and it was very cold. And the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were sleeping in poorly heated buildings on the bare floor. And in order to get votes, Doty sent to, I think it was Galena, to get a wagon load of buffalo robes, which he doled out in return for votes to make Madison the capital. That didn't get him enough votes, so he went around the chamber with his map, promising people town lots at cheap rates or no rates at all for free in turn for votes. So when the voting began, it went through many different places to be named capital. But by the time it ended, a critical mass of delegates already owned property in the imaginary city of Madison.
And had buffalo robes.
And had buffalo robes. And it was called the capital. Now, whether that was bribery or diplomacy is really in the eyes of the beholder.
And our... I'm skipping back and forth here. I kind of like the way you've organized the book in a way, because each chapter you back up a little bit and do a little history and bring us forward to the particular topic. Talk about how your book is organized.
Yeah, the world has enough boring, unreadable history books, and we wanted this to be a popular book.
Yeah.
So the subtitle is Stories of a Monument and Its People, because we wanted to tell stories.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I had a lot of stories near at hand from other research and writing I had done. And so I tried to organize the stories chronologically and then tie them together with transitions that talked about the bigger political questions or political history of the time. You can read the book as a history of politics in Wisconsin if you want to, or you can just read it as tales about the strange people who've worked at the Capitol.
Yeah, and I thought, you know what, I hope that some, even grade schools and high school, upper level grade schools and high school find this book and use it.
It could be. There are certainly stories that teachers could write lesson plans around because they're issues that are still before us today. What's the proper role of government? How much should it interfere in people's personal lives? How much should it advocate for this group or that group? All those are issues that run all through Wisconsin history.
Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty corrupt place there way back when. I mean, the parties in power, whoever happened to be in power, managed to line its pockets.
Yeah, before the Civil War, in particular, it didn't seem to matter which party was in power. Their goal seemed to be raise money through taxes and take as much of it home as you could.
I was absolutely amazed. Talk about our first governor, because he ended up in a kind of a bad way in at the end.
Yeah, the first governor, Nelson Dewey, was sort of a dark horse candidate, a compromise candidate, and no one expected that he would win, kind of like Abraham Lincoln a few years later. But Dewey, in 1848, became the first governor, and his goal was simply to get the state apparatus up and running. Very basic things that we don't think about today, like the state motto, the state seal, things like that. And he succeeded at all of that. And then fell out of favor. He was from a party that then was out of power for many decades. So as the years went by, he was kind of forgotten. And towards the end of his life, after the Civil War, he was granted a sinecure to be an inspector of prisons, and he slept on a cot at Waupun and was largely forgotten. But he had, 30 years earlier, been one of the most prominent people in the state, wealthy, developed the town of Cassville over on the Mississippi River, but fell into obscurity and disregard.
And I think died poor.
Died penniless, yeah, I think.
Penniless. So it was that was an amazing story for me. And you mentioned the Civil War, and that reminded me of another story relating to another of our prominent governors, I believe, who actually went to one of the battlefields and met a bad fate.
Never returned. Yeah, right at the start of the war, Wisconsin troops were among the first fired upon I'm just blocking the name of where it was. This is bad for a historian, isn't it? In Tennessee, and there were no hospital facilities. And hundreds of Wisconsin troops were lying wounded on the ground. And when the word of that got back to Madison, Governor Lewis Harvey marshaled a team of doctors and boatloads of medical supplies and went down the Mississippi and then up the Tennessee to provide relief, which he did. And on the last night before the group were to return home, he was walking between two steamboats and slipped and fell. And the river was running fast and it was dark, and they never saw him again until a few days later when his body surfaced downstream.
Several miles downstream, as a matter of fact. He was did a pretty good job as governor overall, I think.
Yes, he did. And he was well-liked, and he helped to solidify the fledgling Republican Party at the time.
The second Capitol building, I think, when was it, 1883 it started going up?
It started going up in 1859. It took most of the Civil War years to build it, and then it was improved over the decades, for the rest of the century. In, I think, 1883, they were adding two very large wings on each end of the existing building.
Yeah, and there was a lot of construction problems with that first one, wasn't there? Or that second one, wasn't there?
With those additions there were. And on one day that everyone in Madison remembered for the rest of their lives, one of the three-story wings on the second Capitol collapsed as it was being erected, and 30 workers were injured. There was blood running down the outside of the building and a cloud of dust that could be seen for miles around. Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, was a student at the time, and he left a very vivid account of it in his autobiography that he had nightmares for weeks afterwards.
Yeah, there was some poor construction.
Shoddy construction in the foundations, I believe.
Talking today with Michael Edmonds, I want to give you a chance to join in now as well. He is the author of the book, The Wisconsin Capitol: Stories of a Monument and Its People. Join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or comments. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at about 11:45, we will be rebroadcasting an interview that we did with Nancy Zeman when her memoir came out, so I hope you'll stay with us for that. Talk a little bit about the Quilt Expo as well, and of course about Nancy Zeman. Right now, though, we're talking about the Wisconsin Capitol building and hearing some fun and interesting stories from Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach at the Wisconsin Historical Society. His book is titled The Wisconsin Capitol: Stories of a Monument and Its People. And it is really a fun and entertaining read. I much enjoyed reading it. You can join in with your own questions or comments. What was your experience like when you visited the Capitol? questions about its history, I hope you'll join us. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Tell us about the Legislative Reference Library and how it's connected to the Wisconsin idea.
Well, at the turn of the 20th century, when progressive Republicans finally won control of the Capitol from more conservative Republicans who called themselves stalwarts, one of the progressive ideas was that legislation should be written by experts who know what they're doing. Laws should not be made just by people who have special interests. And so Governor La Follette set up something called the Legislative Reference Bureau that still exists today. It was the first in the nation, and it was staffed by people trained from the UW, trained in law and the social sciences generally. The idea was that the expertise of the university would go into making public policy. And so the boundaries of the university became the boundaries of the state. Yeah. This was an idea that was emulated elsewhere. In fact, today every state has the equivalent of a legislative reference bureau, I believe. The first head of the LRB here was a guy named Charles McCarthy, who was a working-class Irish kid from Massachusetts who came to Wisconsin on a football scholarship, I believe. He became a football player and then football coach. And was trained as a librarian and as well as in the law. And he was passionate about the role of expertise in government, that if government was going to work for the good of everyone, the people who wrote the laws should know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a great story. And I think another great story is the whole story, harrowing story of the fire that happened at in the second Capitol, and which eventually resulted in the building of the Capitol that we have now. Talk about that. That was a very interesting time.
It's interesting. I was talking to a group downtown across the street from the Capitol, a large group a few weeks ago about this, and I said, well, I'm not going to talk about the fire because I assume you all know all about it. And they just looked at me. And so people who love the building we have today don't all understand why it's there. But the previous Capitol had been a grand Victorian building added on to over the decades, as we discussed. And one of the improvements made in the late 19th century was to install state-of-the-art fire suppression equipment. That included hydrants all around the outside and on every floor coiled-up hoses on the inside. And on the night of February 27th, 1904, a fire broke out on the second floor about 3 or 4 in the morning. Because a gas jet, which was sort of like a nightlight to be used by the security guards, accidentally ignited a ceiling that had been varnished that day. So the two security guards in the building ran, grabbed the hose, took it over to the fire, turned the valve, and nothing came out. Because the water supply was connected to the universities on Bascom Hill, and the reservoir in Bascom Hill had been drained that day because the university was flushing its system. It hadn't been filled back up high enough to push water all the way a mile away up State Street to the Capitol, and there was no putting the fire out with this state-of-the-art fire suppression system. Before the volunteer fire department could arrive, the fire had spread everywhere, and the downtown sky was lit up with flames. The fire burned for about 12 to 18 hours, and by sunset the following day, only one wing of it was left. Pretty much the whole building was destroyed. Firefighting teams came from as far away as Milwaukee, and they ended up pumping water up out of Lake Monona in order to put out the fire. The governor, Bob La Follette, of course, lived not far away, and the newspaper reports describe him rushing in and out of the building, grabbing the archives of state government, paintings, valuable furniture to get them away from the fire, until citizens just took him soaking wet back to his house and made him stop. Hundreds of university students came charging up State Street, and they formed a bucket brigade to carry volumes out of the Supreme Court's library, one at a time, passing them across the Capitol Square to safety. Some things were saved, but by and large, the seat of government was destroyed that day.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. And And what happened next, I think, is kind of amazing, too, in terms of sort of the commitment to build again and build something really fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. 100 years ago, the state was as polarized politically as it is today, with people on violently opposed on either side of a broad spectrum. But they all got together to build a new capital. They sent out an RFP and decided on a plan by the nation, one of the nation's leading architects, George Post in New York, who sent in a design for the building that we all know today. But the architect was in New York, and so they needed someone on hand to build the building, and they engaged a Madison architect named Lou Porter to oversee the construction project. Now, if you have ever remodeled a bathroom or built your own house, just imagine that exponentially more complicated, and you can identify with Lou Porter. More than 500 different companies bid on 125 different jobs, and on any day, 30 to 40 subcontractors were at work. And Lou Porter had the job of walking around, making sure they didn't try to cut corners or improvise things on their own, but that they stuck to the architect's plans. At one point, he suspected that a railing in one of the staircases was not solid bronze, as the plans called for, and so he grabbed a hacksaw and he just tore into it. And sure enough, it was only bronze plated, and he had it removed and sent back. So he was fairly compulsive or obsessive about the details being done properly. And that's really the reason we have such an amazing building today.
Yeah, we can thank Porter.
Yes, more than anyone else. He's buried over at Forest Hill Cemetery. And if you love the Capitol, I think that you should run over there and say thank you by his grave, because he worked himself to death. For 11 years, he worked on the project, and a few months after it was completed, he died of heart disease and kidney disease.
We have, I'm having a lot of fun, I bet you are as well, listening to Michael Edmonds as he talks about the history of our Wisconsin Capitol. His book is called The Wisconsin Capitol, Stories of a Monument and Its People. And you can join in too with your own questions or comments about it. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. This is so fascinating for me. Ann in Green Bay has something for us, a question. Ann, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. It's a little off the topic, but I think you're doing a historical convention in October. Can you talk about the dates? If there's still availability for that?
Yes, I believe it's the 21st or 22nd and 23rd. If you just go to our website at wisconsinhistory.org, I think it's one of the leading articles on the page. It's going to be in La Crosse, and we normally draw about 400 people who are active in their local historical societies or local preservation commissions. There are 50 sessions over the course of the 2 or 3 days.
Wow, and the thrust of the whole convention is
on how to save local history as opposed to academic history.
Yeah.
And people have questions about everything from how to keep their roof of their 19th century barn from leaking to how to get certified as a nonprofit or how to get federal funding and tax credits.
Wow, so that's up on your website.
That's on the website at wisconsinhistory.org.
Let's go to John in Appleton next. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, gentlemen. I am pretty impressed with the Capitol building that exists today. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the funding for it. I think of the building as being quite opulent with all the beautiful marble and everything. And could you talk a little bit about how that came together?
Yeah, it is opulent, and it was considered extravagant by a minority of legislators at the time. But year after year, they voted enough funds to keep the work going. The total cost was almost $8 million. I don't know what that would be in today's values, but a huge amount of money. There was one legislator who said that he was distressed because the architect's fee was based on a percentage of the total cost, and he accused the architect of trying to line his own pockets by using all that marble from Europe and from hiring the country's best artists to paint the murals that we all love and so forth. But that was a minority voice. Most people involved in creating the Capitol in the years around 1910 were 60, 70 years old. They could remember when people lived in log cabins and Wisconsin was covered in prairie, and they had seen in their own lifetimes two important things that they wanted to be embodied in this new capital. One was that the American experiment in self-government worked. Here you had people from all over the world living in Wisconsin, and they sent legislators to the Capitol, and democracy actually functioned, and that was something to celebrate. The second thing was they had all gone from frontier poverty to tremendous wealth. This was the height of the Gilded Age, and there's wealth on a scale that has hardly been seen since. And they wanted to celebrate that abundance and prosperity. So they went with it. And I don't remember in my research any protests from voters or the general public, just a handful of legislators.
Very interesting. And so the money that came was tax dollars.
Right.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. John, thanks. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. And let's talk about, I mean, for me, and I want to, well, Jean on Facebook says that the first time she saw the building was a grade school field trip, and she was awestruck and says, I've got to get over there and visit again. And I think that was certainly my own impression, not only the first time, but every single time I've been to the Capitol. I'm just sort of awestruck by its grandeur and the sort of feeling you get when you walk into that place. It's an amazing feeling.
It is, and you know, even today, fourth graders still come, Gene. And one of the first things they want to do is lie down on the floor of the rotunda and look up there at the dome, and that's where that feeling of being awestruck comes from. The space is so powerful, and that's intentional. The people who designed it wanted visitors to have that kind of experience. They wanted it to do some conflicting things. They wanted it to be a shrine to democracy and the American way of life, but it also had to be an office building where hundreds of people worked, and so those are kind of conflicting. And then the third thing that it needed to do was to be sort of an art museum, because they had these fantastic paintings and sculptures, and those three purposes don't always harmonize nicely.
Yeah, it was a fantastic job. Mike in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yes, no problem. Thank you for taking my call. I was curious if it's true that there's an underground tunnel to access the Capitol.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are actually more than one tunnel, Mike. One that was built at the time the building was constructed runs several blocks away downhill to the heating plant, which is at the end of Blair Street. I don't know if you know Madison well, but it's towards the east side of Madison. And that tunnel is how the heat came up from the power plant. The janitor, the engineer who ran the power plant, was expected to live and sleep there and be able to have access to the Capitol through that very long tunnel. Since then, I believe there's a second tunnel on the south side that runs over to the Risser Justice Building, which is just across the street from the Capitol. And during the demonstrations of 2011, Governor Walker and other dignitaries came and went through that tunnel, I believe.
Very interesting. Thank you for that question. Appreciate it. And the Capitol itself, the building of it, I remember we had to move people around and in and out, and there were some great stories about some people not wanting to leave their spot so that construction could be continued.
Yes. As the building was built, remember, it took more than a decade to build the building we have today, and as the old burned out part was still being used, as new parts went up, there was great competition between officials to get a new office in a new part. Those were only temporary, because then, you know, another new section of the building would be built and they'd play musical chairs again. And as you say, Larry, some of them did not want to leave their new offices that they liked. In one particular case, Lou Porter had to authorize ceilings to be torn down directly above. I think it was the banking commissioner who was refusing to leave his office. So Porter waited until he was out of town and then got a court order that allowed him to tear down the space, even though it was occupied.
And it was occupied. They started tearing down the ceiling, and then the people who were working below had to hurry up and pack up and get the heck out of there.
That's right. That's right.
I'm telling you, how did the whole design and the bringing in of the wonderful artists and the marble that's brought from different parts of the world and from states, other states as well, if I'm remembering right. How did that all get designed? I mean, you talked about the architect, but did he do all of that?
Yeah, I didn't plunge into it to that level of detail, Larry. I think that Porter was in charge, but you're right, he couldn't have known when every rail shipment of marble was coming from every place to the depot on West Washington and how it was going to get moved up. There had to be foremen and middle managers between him and the craftsmen.
It unbelievable. And there was a lot of, I mean, people had to kind of apply. You had to say, okay, I'll do this part for this amount of money or whatever. But the artists as well, did they not?
Yes, although Post tended to hire artists he knew already. These were mostly East Coast artists who were very well known. He had used them on other projects before. In both the artwork and the overall design, George Post was not interested in current trends in architecture. You know, the building looks, it echoes ancient Greece and Rome, and its art, which was painted in 1910 to 1916, 17, its art looks back to Victorian art of the 1880s, 1890s. So at a time when Picasso was, you know, turning the art world upside down, George Post wanted nothing to do with that.
And I remember one of the legislators being irritated because there was a nude a woman in one of the paintings.
That's right. That's right. People just thought he was a prude, and that stood. But when the war broke out and America joined the First World War in 1917, they decided that certain German icons and motifs had to be covered up, and those were painted over.
Interesting. Rod in Madison, let's go to you next. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The one thing I haven't heard him talk about is the acoustics of the building. In the mid and late 60s, was a time when I was in the pageant at the holidays, usually the second Sunday of December, and the sounds that fill that capital from the choirs and the orchestras that play, as well as the people that play during lunchtime. They used to have string quartets and brass ensembles come in and play for an hour, hour and a half during the lunch hour. It's just amazing. I'm sure that's something they didn't think much about when they put the building up.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, Rod. I don't know if they deliberately set it up or if every dome has those same kind of acoustics. It's beyond my depth.
It's just amazing. I took my granddaughters there. I've told friends about it, and I try to get there every year if I can, just because it just makes the holiday. And I know a lot of people are with the separation of church and state and that type of thing, but it makes for such a wonderful thing to enjoy during the holiday season.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, and I've attended very many times. We were probably in the building at the same time, Rod, because I attended many of those myself. They really are beautiful, and my daughter sang in her grade school sang every year on Veterans Day. There's always a Veterans Day pageant, and they've sung every year during her grade school years. You know, the building. Thank you again. The building fell into, I guess it just neglect and abused. And sometime not too long ago, we actually spent some more money and refurbished it.
Oh, we spent exponentially more money than it cost to build originally. That was between 1987 and 2001. And they very scientifically examined every square inch of that building and put it back to the way George Post and Lou Porter had intended it to be whenever possible. The changes over the years had partly been from neglect, but also from new uses. You know, they needed better lighting. They needed computers, air conditioners, and such. No one was watching over the Capitol for most of the decades of its life. That restoration project, which many Madisonians will remember because the building was boarded up one wing at a time for a decade and a half almost, was really kept moving by Governor Tommy Thompson and Senator Fred Risser, both of whom pushed hard to make it come out right. As with the creation of the original Capitol, the money had to be reauthorized biennium to biennium, and it wouldn't have happened without their pushing on it.
Michael, this has been a great pleasure. We've certainly not covered half of what you write about in your book, and I really appreciate you being with us. Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach for the Wisconsin Historical Society. His book, The Wisconsin Capitol, Stories of a Monument and Its People. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. This is Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We had some sad news this weekend, as a matter of fact. Nancy Zeman, longtime host of Sewing with Nancy, sent out a note of goodbye to her viewers or readers, customers, listeners. Nancy's been battling two types of cancers in the last few years, and a scan in July showed that one of the cancers had metastasized and additional treatments would not be helpful. I have talked with Nancy many times on the show. She was a lovely, warm, and always genuine person, and we're certainly going to miss her, as I know her fans will as well. And we decided to repeat an interview we did with Nancy when her memoir, Seems Unlikely, The Inspiring True Life Story of Nancy Zeman, was published in 2014, and we hope that you will enjoy hearing it again. So let's listen into that. Nancy, great to see you.
Thanks for the invitation, Larry. Always good to be here.
I was really taken by your book. You know, there are things that we don't have in common, but there are some things that we really have in common. And as I read through your book, I thought, man, that's my life in part. We're farm kids.
Sure, right.
So you're a Wisconsin farm gal. And
that's right.
How did that shape your personality?
Well, I think growing up on a farm, for those of us who have, you saw your parents very diligent in their occupations, very fastidious in their finances. They made good decisions, bad decisions. They had to depend upon weather. And so they didn't always have things come their way. And you worked as a unit.
Yeah.
So it gave me a great core.
Yeah, I agree. And when you were a baby, you had Bell's palsy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So tell us what that is.
Sure. It's an infection that came about because of an earache, and the ear infection went to the cranial nerve that controls the face nerve, mm-hmm. you know, the smile and the eye blinking. And 94% of the people who get this recover, and then there's the 6% of us who don't. And I think if I had had steroids when I was back in 1954 it happened, it would go away. But unfortunately, it was just waited out and nothing happened. So, you know, my face is not symmetrical and I can't change it, but it doesn't change my ability to teach or, it's what's inside that's important, not on the outside.
Absolutely. Nancy Zeman, our guest today, author of Seems Unlikely. Great to have her with us today as she talks about her life. How did that affect you immediately?
Well, I was 14 months old, so immediately. I've never known the difference. And so I think if I had to have it, having it all my life is a benefit because I never knew the other Nancy. So I only knew this Nancy. So as a child, oh boy, not so fun. But a lot of people had trouble in grade school. So pretty shy, reserved, very shy.
Yeah. And it actually impacted even into your college career, too.
Yeah. When I went to college, I decided, okay, I'm going to it's a new place. They don't know me. They haven't gone to school with me since I was in kindergarten. And so, yes, I went up to people and say, hello, my name is Nancy Litke. I'm in room 109, Antrim. And they'd say, well, good to meet you. And then next person and next person. And so I had to really just dig deep and put a different, quote unquote, face forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, your memoir is titled Seems Unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that the title comes apart from the fact that you wouldn't expect someone with Bell's palsy to be
right.
a TV personality.
And right, and Seems, a little play on words there, mm-hmm. S-E-A-M-S. And I have to say that people might think it's a heady or pompous thing to write a memoir, but I had so many people inquiring, you know, behind the when I did a Google search for my name to purchase a new URL or a new website, on Google, the most search points came up: Nancy Zeman stroke, Nancy Zeman face, Nancy Zeman smile. And I had to pick up my ego from the floor. No Nancy Zeman quilting or sewing. And so that prompted me to have a neurologist from University of Wisconsin on my program at the end of the show to explain to people, because that's what people want to ask. They want to know, but they're afraid to ask in front of me. They'll ask someone behind me.
But we've actually had people ask right on this program.
They have, and that's fine. It's
you
what
answer.
It is. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
And you answer it. Donna in Cambridge has a comment. Hi, Donna. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear my voice good?
Yes, I can.
Okay, yeah. I've been sewing for most of my life, which is only 21 of my 60-plus years. Actually, the other way around, 61 of my 24 years. These days, I've partnered up with Birdine Feeberger of Fort Atkinson. She was voted best seamstress in the area around Fort Atkinson, and I live in Cambridge myself, and she is the most wonderful, intuitive, almost like the Nancy Zeman personality that I've watched for over 30 years on television when I lived in Milwaukee. Or has it been that long? I know it feels like 30 years. And just learned so much through all the years. And I started out with the frugal necessity, too. My mom passed when I was 12. And I was getting all these clothes from some friends of ours. But they were doable and fixable.
Mm-hmm.
So I hung them all up one time on a clothesline in the middle of our, because we were kind of low-income people, in the front of our living room, because my dad used to dry clothing in the living room on a line.
Yeah.
And I looked at them, and I said, hey, I can do that with that and that and that. And before too long, inside of 2 years, I was altering my own clothes, like with that professional. And I took 2 years of clothing and two years of art in high school.
Well, good for you, Donna.
And I just totally, totally enjoyed every single program that I've watched.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And
keep on keeping on.
And you're very much to be admired for all your intuitive, and you're always a cheerful, perky person on television, no matter what.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. You made my day. Thanks for the nice call.
Thank you so much for calling. And that's great. You're working with a 95-year-old gal, soon to be 96. And I really appreciate the call, Donna. Thank you. I want to give Joe in Harper's Ferry a chance to join in. Harper's Ferry, Iowa. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Say, you know, I'll catch Nancy's shows now and then when I'm flipping around, and I enjoy it because it reminds me of being, I'm a retired carpenter,
mm-hmm.
and it's similar to construction.
Absolutely.
And the precision, the geometry, the techniques are, you know, it's similar to building a cabinetry or a table or even a home. And also find the demeanor of the show quite relaxing.
Well,
I enjoy
great.
It.
Oh.
Well, Joe, I watch This Old House and never plan to fix my plumbing, but I do. I understand what you're saying because I like the processes, too.
Yeah.
You see how
yeah.
it goes together. Yeah. So there's a lot of comparisons.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Thanks,
thank you.
Joe. Yeah, thanks, Joe. Appreciate the call. Speaking of when you got started, mm-hmm. pretty young as a farm girl, and,
right.
and for you too, as probably as our earlier caller, was in part necessity.
Yeah, exactly. In the early years of my life, sewing was economical. Mm. Today, no, it's not. It's a craft. It's a hobby. You can clothe yourself at a discount store much more reasonably, but you cannot make an heirloom, a special gift. from, you know, that's where the importance is now of making something creative, mm-hmm. individual, a memory, and that's where sewing and quilting have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I found interesting, and I'm thinking, well, this was me too. You devote quite a bit of time to your 4-H
right
activities. That was so important for me too. But talk mm-hmm. about 4-H as a big part of your life and why it was so important.
It was very pivotal in a very young age. I found my passion of sewing at 10 years old. My mom became the sewing leader because she wanted me to do 4-H as she had done. And there were like 10 girls in our little 4-H club, Winchester 4-H, and we all made the same thing for about 3 years. And then there was a demonstration contest.
Yeah.
That was I really didn't want to do that, but my mom kind of nudged me into that. And making step-by-step samples for the 4-H demonstration is what I'm still doing today. So a little different, but it's amazing how that is a great organization.
Yeah.
And what a foundation it gave both of us.
Yes. I'm telling you, it's you think about all of the practice you got. I was an officer, but we'd mm-hmm. make these exhibits and so
right.
forth. You learned a lot about displaying, you learned a lot about speaking in front of people
right.
and how to be a leader.
Teamwork.
Teamwork.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's an amazing organization.
Truly is.
And I tell you what, we both, and I owe some of my, or quite a bit of my own mm-hmm. Work, that's where I first learned how to speak in front of people, was in 4-H.
We share that same commonality, yes.
Ron in Milwaukee, thanks a lot for calling.
Well, hi there, I've got two issues that I'd like you to comment about. The first is what I refer to as good goods, and that would be people's ability to discern quality goods in the marketplace. And maybe you can address that from the clothing, sewing perspective. And then the second issue is life skills. Somehow they're not being taught in middle school or high school any longer. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that subject. And I've got to get back to work, so I'm going to take it off the air.
All okay. right. Thanks.
You. Well, Ron, to determine or discern, as you put it, good goods, if you learn to construct something, you don't have to make everything that you wear or that you buy for your home, but by knowing the right way to do it, you can look at something and say, this is of quality, this is not. So knowledge is important, like it is in almost any area. It's the cornerstone. As far as life skills, oh, yeah. Sewing and quilting have math skills. They have life skills that you can learn just to simply put on a button or hem something. It is something that you can use every year of your life, just knowing the basics.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking today with Nancy Zeman about her life and about her book, her memoir. It's called Seems Unlikely, The Inspiring True Life Story of Nancy Zeman. Wendy in Northfield, Minnesota, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and Nancy.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for having this show. Nancy, you are just a fabulous resource in the world of sewing. Your Nancy's
you.
Corner segments
uh-huh.
on your shows, which I don't always get to watch, but it's so important to connect we individuals sewing away in our own little mm-hmm. nooks with the wider world of what's going on. When you've had people on collecting sewing machines to use in Haiti or mm-hmm. quilts for special needs, I think that's so important, and I thank you for that.
You're
and
welcome.
All of the techniques I learn on your show, even though I have been sewing for 50 years, I was lucky enough to live in a house with a lot of kids, and the sewing machine was always set up, and there was always raw material to play around with, and I think that really served me well before that I had a chance to experiment before
sure.
learning in school, which unfortunately most kids don't get to do anymore, and allowed me the freedom to play around. And in speaking of costs of sewing these days, I've always been a secondhand shopper for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So I often find beautiful fabrics and remake them into something that suits me. And I find that when people learn that I sew, they'll give me stuff, give me materials. So I really don't spend much at all.
Well, great.
And I'm lucky to have, you know, to get my creative fix without spending a lot of money. And people pay me to sew for them, too. So
live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
When do you you mentioned Nancy's Corner.
Yes.
I think that's a connect. I call it my connect the dots, part of the program, where I may have someone from, like you say, the sewing machine project, which takes donation of sewing machines. So then you connect, I connect them to you, and it's kind of a full circle. And we have Skype equipment now that we send out to people all over the country, so we can have people in the studio from Kentucky and Kansas City on the same day. It's great.
Oh, wonderful.
It is. Thanks for doing that, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy. A visit with Nancy Zeman. We'll continue with that interview after a look at the news, and we'll be joining our news in progress. So please stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. And today we are sharing an interview we did with Nancy Zeman in 2014. This weekend, Nancy sent a note to her fans announcing that there were no longer any treatments available for the cancer that she had fought for so long. And she ended her message by saying, "I am finding great peace today, knowing that I can thank you for your many years of dedication, viewership, and friendship. I've had a great and long career. I've been blessed to work with quality, amazing people. So with a heavy yet humble heart, I thank you and say goodbye. Your friend, Nancy Zeman." If you'd like to read the entire letter, you can go to WPR.org/sewingwithnancy. There's also a link on our Facebook page. You can go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. What did Nancy teach you over the years? I hope you'll leave your thoughts on our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show, and we will have some time to read some of those notes following the interview. So I hope you will go ahead and do that. Now we will return to our interview, the one I did with Nancy when her book Seems Unlikely, The Inspiring True Story of Nancy Zeman, was published. Let's listen in. Judy in Grand Marsh, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for this, and I'm so anxious to read your story. After we get introduced to you, most of us find out somewhere along the way the name of what you have, but it's your example of courage. I don't know how much you can. It's an emphasis, I'm sure it's something we're going to be interested in, but seeing you every week, every time we see you, what you come away with is that you're beautiful.
Well, and, thank you, Judy.
The example to other people when bullying is so rampant and it's talked about so much, you can't show yourself often enough an example for so many.
Well, I appreciate that comment. I have to say that the reason for writing this is that all of us have issues, whether they're social, economic, physical, whether they happen this decade, all your life, or at some time or the other. We all have stuff to live with, and it doesn't have to define us. You know, it can be there, but we can go beyond it. And that was one of the other reasons to say, if you have stuff, which we all do, have the courage to go beyond it.
Yeah,
that's right. This book should be in every grade school and high school, if they have home economics or not. They should put it close to every young woman.
Thank you, Judy. How kind of you.
Thank you very much for calling, Judy. I appreciate it. You know, everybody who's called said, "Oh, we really enjoyed the show and the programs." I thought it was an interesting story how you got into it in the first place.
I was asked to do a pilot for cable television in 1981, and that was before
we knew what cable was, and it wasn't yeah. holding up your antenna to the top of your roof. And the person I worked with after 11 shows said, this isn't working. Go ahead and do it yourself. And I wasn't going to do it. And I woke up that night in a cold sweat thinking, if you don't do this now, you'll yeah. never have another chance. And I cut my teeth on cable television. There were very few people watching, thankfully, because I had to hone my presentation. And teaching to a camera and teaching to a group are night and day.
Yeah, it's really, mm-hmm. really, really a lot different. And you were on commercial television.
Cable, right. And then 1985, Nebraska PBS made a contact. And so then we were on Nebraska and cable for a time, too. So it was a great multitude of circumstance and blessings that came to me.
Yeah. Ginny and Colby, thanks for calling. Hi, appreciate your call.
Thank you. It's funny. I learned to sew through 4-H, but it wasn't a sewing class. It was a dairy project.
Ah.
I had a nice Holstein heifer calf, mm-hmm. and I wanted a nice blanket for her, and that wasn't in the family budget. And so I took some of my dad's grain sacks, mm-hmm. and on my grandmother's old treadle machine, I made a nice blanket for my calf.
Great.
And I've gone on to sew for my kids and myself, and now I'm a quilter. And I've done custom sewing, and I've done mending and whatever, but I'm quilting, and I'm having a great time. And I still have my grandmother's old sewing machine.
Keep it. It's a treasure, Ginny. And you've learned many life skills of math and being resourceful and the process of assembling. It's great.
She made most of my clothes when I was growing up. She lived with us, and I would stand at the side of the sewing machine, she kept telling me to keep my fingers out of the wheel.
Good advice, right?
Now that you're talking about it, I'm remembering my sister from 4-H, I believe, made a dress out of a flour sack. Or uh-huh. it might have been a feed sack.
Oh, it could be a flour sack, probably. A
flour mm-hmm. sack.
Yeah. My grandmother made me a two-piece outfit out of flour sacks.
Yeah.
I remember that. They were quite popular, and they're very expensive if you can find them.
Yes, now they're very expensive. You're exactly right.
Oh, great stories, Ginny. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, you worked in the textile industry mm-hmm. for several years.
Well, I worked for Minnesota Fabrics, which was, now it's Hancock Fabrics, as their home yeah. economist in Chicago. And each store had a home economist, and we would give seminars each week for about 2 months. We'd give a new topic, sewing swimwear, sewing suede, sewing and quilting. Oh, man, it was a wild ride trying to get ready for a seminar. But it taught me exactly what I do now. I mean, yeah. get ready for a new idea. Not every week, thankfully. But I didn't have a staff. Now I do. So
yeah, you started your own company.
Yes, I did. And yeah. By myself. But then it's no longer by myself. My name's on a building, on a TV show, on catalogs and books. But it takes, you know, I'm the band director. if the participants don't play their instruments, we don't have any music.
Well, and you say in the book that you've always been seen yourself as a teacher, and
I
what are the pros and cons of teaching television viewers? Are there?
Well, teaching television viewers obviously have a wider viewership, but now with everything being online at nancyzeman.com, they can watch 70 shows, current shows. That's the beauty of it. It's accessible, instantaneous information.
And you can see it.
Yeah, right.
And that's the other big thing. Is there a con to it? Is there a disadvantage?
Well, you don't, you know, you have to kind of, you don't get any feedback. You have to kind of have some voice changes, like, they got it. Like, no, you're going to have to understand this. You have to talk to them like they're there. At first, it was pretty, that's what was difficult to learn.
Yeah.
That they were listening. So you had to kind of imagine feedback, imagine their response.
Yeah. Yeah. No, know all about that. Man in Reedsburg. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
I just have a quick comment. I want to, you know, make it clear that, you know, sewing is great for guys to learn, too.
Absolutely.
I use it quite often. I've made window coverings for my deer stand. I've, you know, repairing clothes, whatever. But, I mean, I use it all the time, and it's a good thing to learn for everyone.
Yeah.
Absolutely, John. Good luck. Keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. How about John and Rice Lake? Your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, hey, Nancy. How are you?
Well, John.
I just wanted to share that I grew up in 4-H as well. And the first year, I took a program called Exploring, which touched on a little bit of everything. And I learned to sew on a button and darn a sock and put on a patch. And I also learned cooking and electricity, and eventually went more into woods and electricity. But
sure.
I still love to cook and I still sew. And my mom had an old white. The brand name was White, and it was a pedal sewing machine. And she always told us, the little kids, to stay away from it because she didn't want her needles broken. And so one day she was out doing chores, and I decided to see how that works. And as I was doing that, I put the needle right through the thumbnail of my thumb, and it came out the other side. And of course, I pulled back and broke the needle. Well, I didn't want to get in trouble and tell her. So I got some pliers and I pulled it out myself.
Oh.
That was pretty sore for a long time.
We're cringing here.
We're both cringing.
And then I blamed it on my brother, of course. But he never knew that I did that. But boy, that was I learned real quick to stay away from those moving parts.
Well, life lessons in many ways.
Oh man, a great story, John. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, although you did get us both to cringe a little bit there. Oh, Nancy in Grafton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Well, anyway, I was a farm girl, too, and I lived up in Marathon County. And a week before Christmas, a drunk driver hit my dad's car, and my mother was killed. Well, my little brother, Glenn, was supposed to carry baby Jesus up for midnight mass. And then he wasn't there, and my mother had the material all to make this angel costume gown, and the sisters at school said, oh, we can find somebody else. And I said, no, I think I can do this. So I cut out, and I sat down at that treadle sewing machine, and I was sewing the gown. And it was going pretty good. It was pretty simple. And then there was this gold sticky stuff that you were supposed to put on the armbands and down at the bottom of the hem, and I'm trying to sew this on there. And it was so sticky, and then thread kept breaking, and the needle got gummy, and I said, Mama, help me. And I thought, it came to my mind, if I took tissue paper and put it underneath and over the top, maybe that would work. And by golly, it did. And Glenn carried baby Jesus up in the angel costume. And then another thing was, I had gotten a new black tweed coat that winter. And my mom had worn that on her trip to Owassa. And of course, when she was in the accident, the coat got split down the back and gravel was in it. My Aunt Marie went and sewed it up. She fixed it up, got it cleaned and everything, and I wore that for a long time. But then I got married, and then I had a little girl. And I took my tweed coat apart, and I made my little daughter, Sherry, a nice winter coat out of that. So those are the memories.
What, wow. Heartwarming. Thank you, Nancy.
Heartwarming.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have both of us close to tears here. To be perfectly honest, thank you so much for sharing your story.
I really
appreciate it. Joan in Baraboo, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to call.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I had a stroke following open heart surgery. I'm a quilter.
Mm-hmm.
I was a quilter then, and I'm a quilter now, but it's so very difficult because I have a hard time following directions. I have to reread and reread and reread.
Sure.
And then, you know, it's measured 7 times and cut once and hope you don't cut a finger off. But I'm determined that I'm going to be able to go back to making quilts because, among other things, I have this enormous stash because I keep coming to your quilt expo and going home with
it's cheap therapy.
Yeah, that's wonderful. But I thank you.
Oh, you're welcome,
Joan. You have been an inspiration, and your instructions are so clear when you're teaching something that it makes it much more doable for me, and I really, really, truly appreciate you. So keep up doing this forever.
I'll try, and your perseverance will pay off.
Yeah.
I know it will.
Yeah, thank you very much, Joan, for calling. Betty and Dale, it's your turn. Betty, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
I also like Nancy's program, and especially Nancy's Corner, which a question came up in my mind, and actually then a second one, too. But the first one was my mother, who is 97, I believe,
mm-hmm.
And suffers from macular degeneration, is a lifelong mender. She would mend everything. And now, of course, not being able to see, she really, that's such a hole in her days, you know, not being able to do what she loves. I just wondered if Nancy knew of any simple kind of sewing that, with a machine or by hand, that would be possible for people with limited eyesight.
Hmm.
That's a good, I don't have an answer for that, Betty, but I'm trying to get Nancy's Corner, someone from Texas who's blind and sews thousands of quilts, maybe hundreds of quilts. You jogged my memory to have Lois, my assistant, call her again and see if we can get her on TV.
Yeah, that would be mm-hmm. wonderful.
Okay, we'll take care of that. We'll try to take care of that. Thank you. And I wish I had an answer, but I don't write off.
All right, but Nancy wrote it down.
Yes, I did.
So she made a note, and she'll follow up, I'm sure of that, Betty. Thank you so much for calling. And Jane and Madison, hello.
I just want to tell Nancy that my mother was an expert seamstress. She made men's suits, wedding dresses.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful, but she was a terrible teacher. And never taught my sister and I how to sew, and my sister still breaks out in a sweat when she walks past the sewing machine.
Sure.
So I moved here to Madison and found your program, and I was expecting, and I did a little research, and that was help with your program, and I made my daughter's christening dress. So when
sure.
my mom came and I showed her, I said, look, I got a new dress. And she said, where did you get it? And when I told her I made it, oh, she cried.
Sure. We all have different gifts, you know.
Right. And I told her, you know, I'm old enough that if there's something I want to learn, I'll go find somebody who will teach me.
Sure. Yeah.
And you've been wonderful for all these years. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for calling. That's very, very touching.
Very, very touching. Well, Nancy, I loved your book.
Thanks, Larry.
It's a wonderful read, and I hope you sell a million copies.
That would be nice. Proceeds go to adoption, by the way, some of the proceeds.
Oh, thank you. You've been listening to a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Nancy Zeman in 2014, so a few years back. Nancy sent her loyal viewers, her readers, and customers a note this weekend explaining that there are no longer helpful treatments available for the cancer that she had been fighting. Nancy has been the host of Sewing with Nancy for 36 seasons. Started in a retail store, Nancy's Notions, and was the driving force behind Quilt Expo, an event that she put on for 13 years alongside Wisconsin Public Television. This year's expo is scheduled for this weekend, and it's definitely going on. It's September 7th through the 9th at the Alliant Energy Center, and she wants it to continue. And she really was one of the things that she really has talked about over these last few weeks. She wants it to continue, and she hopes that new generations continue her love for sewing and for quilting. The last episode of Sewing with Nancy that she recorded is called I Sew for Fun. And that was a show on team sewing, excuse me, with the children. And the children were aged 5 through 9. And Nancy's granddaughters are featured. And she says in her letter that she marvels at this miracle. And once again, you can go to her blog, or you can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show if you would like to see the full contents of that letter, that last letter that Nancy wrote. You may have a note for Nancy. You can post it on our Facebook page or on her blog. Her blog is nancyzeman.com. And we've gotten quite a number of comments from people, and I just wanted to read a few of them as we close the program out. Tamara on Facebook says she loves Nancy and has watched her shows for years. It breaks her heart to hear this terrible news. Deborah on Nancy's blog says, you are an inspiration to everyone who has ever had the pleasure of watching your show. Thank you for all you taught me about sewing over the past 20 years. Let's just look ahead here. Margaret on the blog says, the world has been a better place for having you in it. You've made a positive difference in many, many lives. I hope it gives you comfort to know that and to hear it from so many, many others. A few comments. Here's another one. Patrick posted on Nancy's blog and says, thank you, Nancy, for the road you paved for so many others and for all you've offered to creative sewing people wanting to learn more about their craft. Wishing you peace. Michelle says, dear Nancy, I volunteer coming in from Oak Creek at the Madison Quilt Show off and on for the past several years, and it will be with a heavy heart this Saturday, knowing that you will not be here. I wish you and your family, your very large extended family, peace and comfort. No one can imagine all the lives you've touched over the years. Thank you for your motivation and for your inspiration. And Nancy Zeman, a wonderful inspiration to all of us. And it's been my pleasure to have worked with her over the years. She's a very gracious person. I remember many times people asked her about her Bell's palsy while we were on the air, and she always had a wonderful answer for them. And I think one of the best things that you can do to honor her, certainly go to her blog and go to our Facebook page. You can comment there. I'm sure she would take great inspiration from reading those. And be sure to attend the 13th Annual Quilt Expo. It's Thursday through Saturday, September 9th, in the Exhibition Hall at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much for all you've done, Nancy Zeman. Our hearts are with you today.